and I'm going to hand it over to Tim Giesecke. Tim is the groundwater planner for DNR's Division of Ecological and Water Resources in Region 4, the southwest part of the state. He works in New Ulm, and he's been there since 2016. He holds an MS in Environmental Sciences and has written two books on the socioeconomics of landscape sustainability, Eco-Commerce 101 and Shared Governance for Sustainable Working Landscapes. At the DNR, Tim leads the delivery of the Community-Based Aquifer Management Partnerships Program, also known as CAMP, where he's responsible for increasing awareness and engaging communities as it relates to co-managing aquifers. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Ellen. I appreciate being in front of the crowd here and tell our story and get some feedback on where we could and should go on the community efforts. So I, as Ellen said, I've been around it since November of 2016. I was brought on board to fill some gaps on communicating with local governments on their water supply. Southwestern Minnesota has a lot of smaller, isolated aquifers. They're shared by multiple users. Often they're not familiar with each other. And so the task ahead was, how do we communicate with our communities and get them aware of their situation, whether their aquifer is rising, declining, or staying the same? So I have a presentation today that I give to communities. I've added a few things to it, but generally this is what they see and can react to it. So it's a Region 4 pilot effort, although we're ready to kind of take it up the next step and work with half a dozen or a dozen communities, generally smaller ones. And so as the presentation goes, the last six slides or so are about the community aquifer management partnerships. The first part is connecting water, culture, and science, and then added a few slides on wicked problems and how groundwater fits into that. You, if you put that word in your vocabulary, you'll start hearing it more often. A couple years ago at the Governor's Water Summit, Greg Page, worked for Cargill, brought that term up and discussed it, and you see it surface around, and throw a few slides in there on how I see that situation with groundwater. So the core of the CAMP effort is groundwater is a common pool resource, meaning multiple entities are sharing it. It's an issue that's been around as long as humankind have been sharing resources. So CAMP is approach to manage this common pool resource. There's a paper on the bottom there, Leveraging Points for Sustainability Transformation. DNR leadership shared that last summer, did a science chat about that related to that, and so I kind of structured CAMP around that. It basically says reconnect people with use and management of the resource. The first few slides are on that. Rethink how people contribute and use that knowledge, and then restructure how organizations work together. So that's kind of how the presentation is will unfold here. So good communities, you kind of work them from the global, state, to local picture. So have them grasp that. And you know, we often, well, we're very familiar with the earth is covered with two-thirds water. But it's kind of deceiving how much water is available. So if you look at that big blue bubble on the right-hand side, that's all the water on the earth. So if you pop that bubble, it will fill up all the oceans. So saying our world is two-thirds water is like saying your house is two-thirds paint. You know, you look at your house, it's basically we have a planet that's painted with water. There's another little bubble there that's all the fresh water on the planet, and there's a bubble there that you can't see that's all the rivers and streams. So people get a sense that there's water everywhere, but relatively speaking, you know, if you think about that large ocean plastic island we have out in the Pacific, you know, that has to fit in that bubble along with everything else we do. So, and then bring it down to state level. There's the water appropriations for groundwater we have in Minnesota, about a half a billion gallons per year. And, you know, what does that mean from a community's perspective, from a state's perspective? So you put the state of Minnesota up there and circle the 10 largest lakes we have. You know, how long would it take to consume that water if we just appropriated that half a trillion gallons a year from there. And, you know, when I penciled this out, I didn't quite believe it at first, had some people check the math, but it'd take about 10 years for us to use the 10 largest lakes in Minnesota. So it's more than just a drop in the bucket we're using. We're using a cup of the bucket. I mean, obviously those lakes fill back up again, but, you know, and some aquifers do and others don't. So it kind of gives a sense that we are using a lot of groundwater. And then we get it down to the local level. And used an analogy here is if you have a water tower that's a half a million gallons, you know, it's like, so the kind of there's a poster like this, or we ask the community these questions is, how many groundwater or how many water towers per year are used to do these land use activities? So you look at that list on the right, you know, how many water towers does it take to supply 10 leaky toilets in a community? How many does it do for a hog farm? So as, you know, when we're at some kind of a public forum, I'll put those sticky notes over those numbers and, you know, force people to open them up. But, you know, as you can see, you know, as these land uses are implemented, if you want 100 quarter acre lawns, the community should plan for 22 of those water towers. Town of population, you know, dairy farms, 18 hole golf course, 160 acre cornfield, and, you know, and food processor, that varies depending on the size, and 100 million gallon ethanol plant. And so we kind of look at this as, you know, your, you know, accounting for your land use. And really what the you know, one of the first things I was told when I brought on is, you know, land use is water use. Land use decisions are water use decisions. And we have local land use authority and we have state appropriations authority. And if the local land use, local governments are saying yes to land use decisions, they're going to expect a yes at the water use level. And so we try to get that those decisions more aligned with each other, because it puts appropriators and decision makers in tough spots if there isn't enough water, but they've already approved a cheese processing plant or whatever it may be. So that brings it, like say, from the global state to the local, they can pretty much understand. And then part of it is kind of that, I think I bring it up later, the groundwater checking account. If you put a line on the bottom there and add up how many of those things you want, you know, is that an amount that supplies your community? So how does this all happen? You know, Minnesota, we have a culture of, we're proudly industrious when it comes to natural resources. You know, we have this idea in our head that there's water everywhere. And so you just kind of move forward with that. So, you know, it's in our culture. It's woven pretty deeply into it. So just kind of a few examples of how industrious we are. You know, a statistic I found not too long ago I was surprised at is, you know, by 1890s we hit peak lumber, meaning we had the technology and economic incentives to cut down every old growth pine tree in the state. And, you know, when you look at the word technology, you think of different things than that, but really that was the technology needed to, you know, really go through our forests. And we, you know, and you know, what made us stop cutting white pine trees down? Well, by the 1930s, we pretty much got them all, you know, so we went through that resource. You know, by the 1980s, we had the technology and economic incentives to drain, you know, many of our wetlands to grow crops. And, you know, what slowed us down on that? That was the Swamp Buster Farm Bill in the 80s and the Wetland Conservation Act. But without those two items, I think that would have been steaming ahead as well. And I've spent 21 of my years farming. I understand the economics of it. You know, you push forward, a spring like this, you wish you had every acre tiled, you know, and so next year, if you have the money and the tiler is the time, that field's getting tiled next year. So, I mean, without that, without a governor on there, we would, that, if you look at that bottom right-hand picture, there's a wetland way in the back there. You know, I assume without the Swamp Buster and Wetland Conservation Act, that tile machine would have just kept going. And now we're, you know, in the 2000s, we have the technology and economic incentives to overpump many of our aquifers. And there's a lot of new technologies out, horizontal, subsurface drainage. I kind of pick on agriculture here, but there's other incentives as well. You know, so then the question I'd like to throw at the community, or not necessarily throw at them, but present it, is, you know, so why won't we? You know, why won't we overpump our aquifers? If the economic incentive is there and the technology is there, what's going to stop us? So, you know, and No one sometimes haven't asked that, and they, you know, some answer, they, you know, it's not a rhetorical question, it's, you know, it's a question. Some say, well, we want it for our grandchildren. Okay, that's a reason, but, you know, that's the reason why you won't, but, you know, who is going to do that? Some people don't have grandchildren, you know. So, kind of lay this out there is, here's a cross-section of a real aquifer, and a stacked aquifer, and, you know, if people are going to request permits, and we're going to keep adding wells, and if it's an economic advantage to have that, chances are the neighbors are going to put them in as well to keep up. You know, they're going to keep adding them on there. And so you get to the point where I think I'm going to. So, you know, how many straws is too many straws? And who decides? Well, of course, the DNR has responsibility for appropriating waters relative to the available amounts. But there's a lot of other issues that get thrown into that. I mean, there's economic and social economic issues were brought up. There's a lot of dynamics involved. It's our culture. These are these wicked problems. So one of the ways we approach this is, you know, the groundwater is a checking account. You know, you have deposits, you have withdrawals, you know, you have overdrafts perhaps. But of course, it's not that straightforward. I mean, this is a nice diagram, but this is not how it happens. So, and if you look at it something like this, here's probably a more realistic checking account. You know, you have a lot of unknowns in there. You have, you know, a lot of scientific information there, technical knowledge, but there's a lot of social and economic pieces and political pieces in there. So, you know, when a community sees these maps, they, you know, they are step back a little bit and say maybe we don't, you know everything. But, you know, this is where probably your expertise is, well, I know your expertise is a lot farther in than mine on this, but, you know, how do you present this checking account situation? So, so here's a simple diagram that, or a matrix that, you know, just kind of sets the stage for what issues we do have. And so it's basically having values, or excuse me, have a consensus or disagreement on values and knowledge. And this kind of sets up what issue do you have. And so with groundwater, think of it as fens. So if you have if you believe fens are a good thing, and you know that pumping a certain aquifer is going to drain that fen, you have a technical problem. So just basically you have to calculate out how much you can pump to save it. Well, if you value fens, but you're not sure how much pumping it's going to take, you have a scientific problem. So someone's got to, you agree to it, but you're not agree on this, on, you know, what is actually the case. Well, things get a little more complicated when you, maybe perhaps you, on a fan, you understand the pumping will affect it, but you disagree that there's a value to a fan. You know, fans are nice, but, yeah, you know, they're nice. So you're going to have a political problem. So you understand the science, you agree with it, but you disagree on the value. And then we go down to you disagree on the knowledge. You're not sure if the pumping affects the fan, and you really don't have a value of the fan. You have a social problem. And that's where a lot of our groundwater issues reside, is we don't really agree on the values of the resource, and we don't agree on the science of the resource. And what Rattel and Weber claimed in 1973 is you have yourself a wicked problem. And that's where a lot of issues are, is people don't agree on the knowledge, they don't agree on the values, and you know, how do you move forward on that? So there's a lot of definitions of wicked problems and how they are, and Rattel and Weber have like 10 characteristics of them. But as you see this come up more so, you know, there'll be different ones. Here is my favorite one, the one I kind of work with. There's mathematicians in the room, I assume, and I just wanted to put a math equation to this, so if you want to do that, it's fine, but I mean, I appreciate it. So what makes a problem wicked, all right? You got a system with inputs, outputs, and outcomes that vary in time, scope, and scale. So that's starting to get messy right away, okay? You got with system users and stakeholders that use different methods to measure and value. the varied input, outputs, and outcomes of a system. Okay, you probably all are there. I mean, you probably live that. And then you get it from organizations that have disparate governance frameworks for applying the different measurements and values for various methods. Okay, it doesn't even seem like it's quite fair that we have to do this. But this is how it, you know, this just compounds it. And so there is a math equation there, and I'd like to see it, but I don't know my math that well. So what you have is organizational structures and processes, you have social economic values, and you have technical and scientific data. And how you address each one of those is important for how, and you know, the gentleman here that spoke about Kansas, I mean, he can appreciate some of these, and or Nebraska, sorry. Yeah, I mean, some of those things probably emerge. Yeah, all of them, yes. And if you're conscious of them, they're easier to deal with. So, why wicked problems now? A couple years ago, I worked with the Minnesota River Group and kind of scratching our head on this. You look at the Minnesota River Basin, and, you know, pre-1950s, there was these organizations mainly involved with the Minnesota River quality and quantity. You can see their government agencies, University of Minnesota. I mean, this wasn't a great in-depth scientific research, but generally had people give me this information. I compiled it for them. And so you can see, you know, there's very, those are very well-known organizations working on this. Well, if you go to the pre-1980s, you start getting, you know, a broader sense. You get some nonprofits in there. You get some different government agencies. You start recognizing them. Deer Hunters Association. You get some of those organizations involved with it. Well, then you get past the 2000s. And if you look up there, you might see your name, but sometimes people look up there and go, I don't even see us up there, you know, because you only have a partial list. So, you know, you go back to that wicked problem is organizations with different structures, with different values, with different technical data. And, you know, in the Minnesota River has been working with trying to get the organization together on how to address that. And, you know, it's like, where do you start? Well, I think in groundwater in the future, I mean, this watersheds have been, you know, groundwater knowledge, as we learned today, is in organization isn't as old as surface water issues, but you definitely can see organizations creeping into the groundwater story, and there's a lot on there of organizations that necessarily, these aren't new organizations from the 80s, they're just organizations that adopted new values. In the 80s, you wouldn't find the Minnesota Corn Growers Association talking about groundwater, surface water, I should say, but they're very well informed now, and they support studies, and they do on-site research, and they do policy. So a lot of these organizations were in existence. They just came aboard, and they come aboard with groundwater issues as well. So, and then the last one on wicked before we get to the topic of the conversation. Oh, here, just never before has so many diverse organizations worked side by side to see a common objective. So it's a good news, right? The good news is we're there. The bad news is it's kind of messy. So how do we often approach wicked problems? When I read that, it's like, what does that mean? So, you know, there's better ones up there that are less politically correct. I think it's an Englishman by a pub, and, you know, but basically, you know, why would you look for something where the light is, but where you didn't lose it? Well, we have a tendency to do that in our work. You know, do we look for a technical solution in a social problem? You know, if we just tell them more what the data shows, won't they just believe us and move forward? You know, and or we just need more science or, you know, or political and social solutions. So, I'm not saying technical and scientific solutions aren't part of it. They absolutely are. You know, they kind of all are. You just have to present them in a manner, in an order that is accepted. If you lead with technical and they don't believe on your disagreement on values and knowledge, that will go right over their head and antagonize them and things like that. So what situation do you have in a hand, and what's your tools? Make sure you use your tools at the right time. So that's that mess. So we go to the camp. How do we approach camp then? If we have this mess in front of us and disagreement on knowledge and values, well, the DNR deals with groundwater quantity and availability. We have partner agencies that work with groundwater in different capacities. So as a part of the position that I was brought on for was to help communities address water quantity issues. We find out one of the first things they ask or expect is it recharges, right? You know, because they want to use the resource, they don't want to destroy it, but they want, you know, to have their cake and eat it too. They hope and it works. Well, as those questions expand, the other organizations are quickly involved, but we start with the groundwater story on the quantity. So we haven't done a whole lot of these, but we've done enough to get a sense for what people have an interest in. And, you know, we've made our mistakes. We've kept them small. We started off with we kind of fell into our own trap. We got all this technical data. We're going to make sure that we present it properly. But we quickly backed off on that because we saw what people actually wanted. They can't digest it all. They want to understand it. So we really have come down to having three pieces of information that we start off with. We give them their aquifer cross section. We give them their groundwater use trends. And we give any observation well data we have. And when we went through that, we went to the local government staff first and kind of explained what we were doing and what they knew. And they said, well, you should talk to city council. Well, the county also, the aquifer goes into the county, so talk to the county board too. And then talk to the water task force. And as we went through those, as we got invited to keep going, we never veered off these three. You know, this is all the information they wanted. It gives the community the opportunity to ask the next good question. They would ask, oh, is this the only place in the county that this is a problem? We said, no, there's others too. And then, you know, the more technical person with me would explain, you know, these are the areas on there. So now they ask the question, they lead the conversation. They start taking ownership of the data. They ask, is that data good? You know, is it any good? I mean, is it right? You're the DNR, are you giving us right information? Well, there's an ethanol plant in this aquifer that has similar data, you know, and then you can start lining up people that they may trust more. But, you know, it's we're still at two pages. We haven't, you know, expanded on that. There's side questions, but we haven't buried them yet. So that's how we start with it. And then we, you know, look at that broader picture of where they fit in. And this kind of helps people get out of their silos temporarily. So, you know, you can work for a public entity or a private entity. You can be a policymaker or a practitioner, basically, you know, and you can probably find yourself somewhere in there. So public policymakers, your legislators, your county boards, city councils, your public practitioner, people like myself or the area hydrologist, people that, you know, kind of a hands-on person, but do it for the public good. And then, you know, the private policymaker, this is kind of a new group. 10 years ago, probably wouldn't had this conversation too much, but you're familiar with General Mills and Walmart and Hormel and, you know, all these entities that are creating policies or procurement policies for their commodities. You know, we want corn grown in this manner. So, you know, the agriculture community is well aware of these. They feel that pressure from them to change policy. So basically it's, if we're in an area that we're aligned with a corporation that has a policy goal, you know, we should probably be aware of that. We have similar goals, not to gang up on the farmers so much, but they'd rather probably see that our policies are aligned. But, in my previous career, I tell agriculture organizations, if you want concerns, you probably should be more concerned about the private policymakers than the public. And they actually said, well, yeah, you're right, because we can't do much when the private policymaker makes a decision. When the public policymaker says, and there's always that next monkey wrench to throw in. So, you know, they understand that role in the sustainability movement. And then you have the private practitioner, those that use the water, that produce it and all that. Now, what's interesting about this, well, each one has unique risks and information to them. You know, there's no one has the social, economics, technical, and scientific information on any aquifer. So that, but also what they realize is they may be wearing multiple hats. They may be a farmer that's on the county board, that's on the ethanol board. And do they, are they aware that they're wearing different hats for different reasons at different times? Just give them that dynamic to say that there's, and like I say, it brings people out of their silos for a little bit, looks at themselves as an individual within that situation. So this actually gets good conversation with as people kind of look around and see who they are and who their neighbors are. And then we kind of break the story up into management units. You have the gray infrastructure that communities are very well aware of. They know what it costs. They know what the deterioration is. The blue infrastructure is what we provide. What does the shape of that aquifer look like? And then the green infrastructure, as we call it, where does it get recharged? So, which part of that management unit? And if you look at those three, each farm has one of those, all three of those, each community has three of those. So they're somewhat scalable as well. Some people care about one and not the others, and they can kind of align themselves. So, and then we're all familiar, and almost everyone's familiar with the hydrological cycle. And what they're not familiar with is how much that has changed. How much we saw the white paper on the drain tile, the infrastructure of the well pumping, the change in the landscape. So is the community's hydrological cycle sustainable? Have we modified it beyond the extent that it is functioning? And, I don't blame a lot of people for not knowing this in Minnesota. It's our understanding that water is everywhere, but a lot of communities are very unaware of their water cycle and how it's going to feed. And then just to kind of personalize that graph a little bit, are you a private practitioner? Are you a farm that uses it or a community? Or even, look at it, the DNR fisheries is really, in quotes, a private practitioner as in the use of groundwater. I mean, so when you look at private, it's kind of a parochial interest as well. And then the public legislators and the policymakers. So, we can do this for a aquifer and kind of lay that out and what you end up doing or seeing is usually that bottom left-hand corner is highly populated. And they begin to see themselves as sharing an aquifer, this common pool resource. And it's not so much the DNR isn't preventing me from using my water, but I have to share this water with 45 other people that may be using more or less than me. And it changes that dynamic. So we have a conversation on it. So here's where, selling the camp to the community. Jurisdiction boundaries, aquifers do not follow them. We have some communities that have water supply plans, which are very good plans for them to understand their infrastructure, but sometimes they'll share an aquifer and not be familiar with it. Users are interdependent on other users. Local land use decisions are de facto groundwater decisions. The community gets to understand their groundwater story, and it's this whole process is supportive for co-managing their aquifer. So the whole concept here is it connects community and culture with science and technology. We bring the people in from a different perspective and kind of show them where, what parts of that hydrological cycle they have an interest in. So that is community-based aquifer management partnerships.
Hey Tim, over here. I can't resist asking. How have people taken? What has been your response? Have you had pushback? Have you had people jump on board with waving flags, or both, or what?
Right. Yeah. So when we this is something we just opened a box and did. The acronym itself didn't form right away, and so it was several months where I was given criteria on what to be accomplished and would feedback, and I'd go digging and come back and. And there's enough people that play devil's advocate in the office, so which is good. And so one of it was, well, what if you go present this and they say they don't care? And I said, well, so like I said, I've been involved with natural resource management for 20, 30 years, but not so much in groundwater. And I said, well, the story you guys put together and the data that you have, I said, I think that there's going to be enough reasonable people in the room to continue the conversation. So that was kind of the premise. We weren't sure. But And the Benson area is the one we've moved farthest along. So, we went there and talked to the local government staff first. The area hydrologist, is the local connection. So he invites me in and some state agency people and the local government. And just, that was our, we had that 20-page workbook document. You saw them flipping through it, looking for kind of that simpler data. I would have to say cautious acceptance would be maybe a good way. So they, they had some questions on it, but they did say, why don't you talk to the county board and city council? So we went there, and I was always looking for permission, invitation to keep moving forward, but we'd present this, information, and, we're obviously in close contact with the environmental service director and all that, and so they were kind of looking to us for the lead, like, well, what are you going to, do with it, and so we said, well, we plan on working with the environmental service director and kind of make this more public forum, to answer your question is, we haven't had as much resistance as we probably thought we would. It's been, they see that we're going to communities that we need to be in, ones that are declining aquifers or so. So once we present that information, they take a little ownership of that problem and want to know more. And really, there's not, a city council has a lot on their table, a lot on their plate, and the council. Boards do. So when you give them information that looks like there's a story there, they're willing to pursue it. So we've also went to some counties that had looking for feedlot compliance on their water appropriations. So you have a more a crowd that has a more vested interest. But when we go there with this camp approach, it isn't just it invites the community, and so you have a mix of people, even though it's about that. So there always seems to be a dynamic, and there's always someone that's interested in that supply. So I guess we feel there's always enough people there that have an interest that want us to go forward. So it's been good. There's a question here.
Yeah, my question is, I'm just trying to get an understanding of how you're involving the people of these communities. Are you getting people together for meetings? Are you...
Sure.
Coming up with a plan, a series of meetings?
Yeah. So, I go to the, the area hydrologist, the people that issue the permits to the community, basically take their lead on that. But what we've seen, to be positive, we haven't done a whole lot of these, but if we talk to local government staff first and tell them, because they're involved with resource management, and they too don't have, as we saw earlier today on the study of the SWCDs and groundwater, they're looking for groundwater information. They want to be involved. So when we go to them, this gives them something to hang on to, something to grab, something to, a lot of the SWCs do well monitoring for the DNR. Some aren't familiar with the aquifer they're measuring it relative to the county and community and others. So we give them that context of what their data is used for. And they've been positive about being involved in that, too. So just basically think of it as concentric circles, just a little bigger. As long as they invite us to the next one. So up in the Benson area, our next plan is to have a public forum kind of the same way. So this is to be the first time we actually get people there in an evening and show all these graphs and the use. And what really the idea is, if a community has a downward trending aquifer and they're having an increased number of permit or appropriation requests, who decides? Does local land use decide, or does the state appropriation decide, or they, ideally they both decide? So what we're trying to do is set the table for them, not to leave, but these wicked problems can't be managed by one entity, is what the point is. And if they're going to have to, if we get 1988 drought again, my limited technical knowledge of this, I would say, someone else could disagree with me, I would say there's going to be some taxed aquifers in a 1988 groundwater or drought situation. who decides how that gets dialed down? Of course, the DNR has responsibility for it, but if you don't have the community involved in it, it's the task is so much greater. Because these are people's livelihood. If you own irrigation equipment, when would be the most ideal time to use it? Well, when there's a drought and crop prices are going up, and that's the time you can't use it. I mean, there's some very serious issues there, economic, socially, politically. And so it's the local land use decision makers and the public that affects them. We're trying to bring them into our fold. So it's not a short-term deal. I should say, some communities, we can probably go there and tell their groundwater story and really be done. As long as they're aware that land use is water use, there's a groundwater checking account situation. But if they don't have any growth and they don't have any problems, that knowledge is probably one and done. They'll know it for a few years. But these some communities that want to go farther is where we, you know, get our most value there. So.
Well, thank you, Tim.
Yes.